Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Frances Diggelspiel, and I'm moderating this panel today. I'm really excited to talk about these three books. They're all very, very different books. One is sort of a debut novel. Hers is a debut novel. Christian has written a number of novels, so they're very, they come from different places in the author's journey. And they talk about different topics, but there is an element of mystery in all of these books, and there are secrets in these books about race, murder, sexism, elitism, espionage, and I think in some ways it's a very appropriate to talk about sort of the underworld in today's America. I mean, we are living in a time where the truth is not necessarily the truth. It's fake truth. It's fake news. In America, sadly, I think we're up for a debate about what is true and who can you trust and how do you decide who you trust. And I think all of these novels sort of touch on that topic to some degree. So even though they're very different, I think they have something to say about the times that we're living in. So I thought we'd start just by having the authors introduce themselves and talk a little bit about what their books are about before we sort of go into larger questions about, you know, the writing and the themes and that kind of thing. Takis, do you want to start down there?
Yeah. It's actually the most embarrassing part of being a writer is to paraphrase your book in five sentences. My name is Takis Würger. I'm German. If I don't write books, I work as a journalist and for a German news magazine called Der Spiegel. And my novel is called The Club. It's about a young man who comes to England to study, and then by chance, pretty much, he becomes a part of British upper class stuff, and he's supposed to investigate a crime in a club at the University of Cambridge, and so it's very tricky. That's kind of what it's about. I don't know. Is that enough?
That's enough for now. We don't want to give the secrets away too soon. Lauren?
Hi, everyone. My name is Lauren, and this is my book, American Spy, which I did not bring, but luckily a panelist has. The prop is great. It is about my main character's name is Marie Mitchell. She is an FBI agent who is approached by the CIA, and they want her to help them undermine Thomas Sankara's Marxist government. He was a real revolutionary leader in Burkina Faso in West Africa in the 80s. So I guess that's pretty much the plot.
First off, I'm super excited to be on this panel with these people. I read both of these books, and they're lovely and wonderful and harrowing in all the best ways. I wrote a book, too. The new book's called Phantoms. It is about the legacy of racism in Placer County, where I live, which is east of here. It has to do with the Japanese internment. It's effectively about a white writer in the 80s recounting something that happened to him in the 60s about something that happened in the 40s. So it's sort of three levels of deniability. The model for it is something like Sophie's Choice, where the downstairs neighbor is telling the story of the upstairs neighbor who's also telling her own story. So it allows for me to acknowledge my own privilege as a white writer and to potentially make mistakes and to have somebody in the narrative who doesn't quite know what's going on. It's also about who controls the story, whose story it is to tell, the sort of white patriarchal view of America as a particular kind of we, that is, you often possessive pronoun that, or a plural pronoun that is weaponized to mean other than white, sort of heteronormal male personages in the novel. It sounds like a bummer. Now that obviously it's just a comedy. Laughs in it.
So
this is yours.
Oh. Christian, can you talk maybe a little bit? Yeah, I know more. Yeah, about how you got the idea for this book. I know you grew up in Placer County. You lived in this town in which you describe. You mentioned that it's a book about race and Japanese Americans, and yet certainly that history has been hidden to some degree. And it sounds like you went through a process of trying to find out more about that history. And can you tell us a little bit about how this book came to be, how long you've been thinking about this idea, and sort of what propelled you finally to make this the next book for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm not somebody who believes white people need to be talking more about race right now. I think white people largely need to shut the hell up and listen to a conversation that involves them but doesn't need to involve them. So I have to start by apologizing for writing a book that's about race. Despite all that, I really have... I'm not a guy with multiple ideas. Like, I have an idea and it won't let go of me until I write the book, and then I can hopefully by the end of that I have the next idea. So I don't have a bunch of plates to choose from. I just have the one. This one sort of haunted me. Placer County that I grew up in, I grew up in Auburn, the town I still live in. It was about 6,000 people. I had sort of an idyllic country childhood. You know, we had a cow and a couple sheep and, you know, a flock of chickens. I'm sure we covered the internment in school, but it was sort of like abstract part of California history. It never occurred to me growing up that it happened in my town to every town in California and up the West coast. Looking back at newspapers from the 40s, early 40s, and then into the late 40s, just uncovered a horror, really. The Placer High School yearbook, 1942 or so, is maybe 40% Japanese American faces. The Placer High School yearbook in 48, 49, there's maybe six people of clearly Japanese American or Japanese American descent, which means, which told a story in itself. Our neighbors were shipped off and largely did not return. Instead, the people of my county resettled in places like San Jose, San Francisco, Seattle. And that kind of willful blindness to the history of our community was bothersome enough for me to keep kind of pulling at that string and tugging at that string. For a long time, I had a crisis that I've already made sort of obvious, which is like, how can I, or even should I, write about the Japanese and Japanese American people in my community? And the only way I could think of to do that is by directly addressing my own sort of privilege as a white writer, which is encapsulated totally by the notion that I would even think about writing outside of my lane, which is itself a kind of privilege. The freedom to do that. I was very concerned with sort of white savior narratives. I'm sorry, I'm just going on and on and on. I was very concerned with like white savior narratives and how not to write Snow Falling on Cedars again, which I think is in many ways a beautifully written book, but it sort of falls into all the traps of sort of a white savior narrative. And one of the takeaways of the book is the white narrator of the book, in fact, realizes that he's not even needed to tell the story, actually. The story just sort of falls in his lap and he tells it. But even in sort of failing, he fails upward, as white people do in their own narratives. There is no failure for white narrators. They always fail up, you know. Viet Thanh Nguyen talks about that in his nonfiction. Okay, that's something. Okay. I could go.
We'll get back to the whole question of, you know, writing outside your race and gender and all that later in the discussion. So, Lauren, can you tell us a little bit about how you created this Marie Mitchell, this, you know, badass, incredibly complex, you know, woman who finds herself in so many interesting and disturbing situations?
I was in grad school, actually, and I was assigned, the assignment was to write a suburban story that was not what we thought of as the typical American suburban story, which is, you know, deals with white middle class and longing, I guess. And so I had an image in my mind of a woman who was a mother, a black woman who just by all, you know, looks like a regular mom until an assassination attempt sort of reveals that all is not what it seems in her life. And then, so it just kind of, you know, it just snowballed from there. You know, I didn't set out to write a spy novel. I didn't know that I could write one. It just, every question that I had about the narrative, the most interesting answer to me was that it was based, you know, in her background, and that her background was one as in which she'd lived as a spy. And that's kind of how it got started. I mean, that story, the professor who assigned it was an editor, and he published it. And then, the woman who would become my literary agent read it and asked if I could write a novel version. Her interpretation of that conversation was that I seemed really cool and relaxed about it, but inside I was like screaming, like, yeah, of course, like, I'm gonna try, I have nothing else going on, like, let me see if I can try to write a novel. Yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah, I'll write whatever you want me to write, you know, if you'll represent me. Like, that's definitely how it felt at the time. So yeah, and then after that, kind of the rest was, I mean, I want to say history, but that implies that there was some ease in the process, and that is not the case. It was difficult. It took a long time, maybe 6 or 7 years to write this book. So tell me about it.
That's the story. What did it take so long?
I'm hinting at it, right? I didn't know I was writing a spy novel. I, like, didn't know much about the genre. I kind of had this idea, and then I kept following narrative threads, and then I would be super into them and realize, like, 6 months later that they weren't taking me anywhere. I mean, you know, I wrote a draft of this book where, like, she doesn't start spying until, like, on page 250 of like 300, like, she like takes a road trip. I kind of really was all over the place, and I just was, because I guess I didn't know what I was writing to. I didn't have this specific idea in mind.
So that agent calling you is a blessing and a curse, because of course it's great to have someone who wants to represent you, but you still then had to go do all the hard work to get your novel somewhere, and that can take a very long time, as you say.
Yeah. And also, she's, you know, tough. So that draft in which she goes on a road trip, I gave it to her, and she was like, this is terrible. And I'd worked on it for 10 months, and then I was like, yeah, you're right, you know, so... It wasn't easy, but...
Did you read a bunch of spy novels?
I did.
Oh, that's my question later. You can ask that, yeah.
I will.
Okay, Takis, you're a journalist. Maybe you write more quickly than people who don't have that background. How did you come to this idea? Tell us a little bit about what led you to this
story.
You wrote
this in like 3 days, huh? That's what you're going
to
say.
Actually, I decided not to tell how much time it took because it...
What, am I going to be jealous?
You just sound like you just sound like you didn't take it serious. I wrote it because I was in love with a woman, and the only way to be with her was to write this book. It's actually true. Yeah, because I went to Cambridge pretty late when I was 28.
So this book takes place in Cambridge.
Yeah.
Part of it. Yeah,
and then I dropped out. And I dropped out because I love this woman in Vienna. Mm-hmm. But I had a contract with Der Spiegel, with this German magazine, and they told me, you're allowed to go to Cambridge, But if you graduate, you have to go back and work with us as a journalist. I didn't graduate, I just dropped out, and then I knew I had to go back. And the only reason this magazine accepts when you say you need 6 more months to do something else is if you tell them you have to write a book. So that's what I did. And then I sat in Vienna, and I was in love with this actress, and she always played, so I had time, and I came up with this idea, and then when I started writing it, I actually realized this is it. Mm-hmm. It was the most fulfilling work I've ever done, and so I never, you know, you probably know these stories of other writers who say, when I was a kid, I was this shy kid, and I lived in this world made out of books, and I read all, you know, I read everything. I read Nabokov when I was 9, and I always felt weird in the world, and I just wasn't like that. I didn't read much. I played basketball when I was a kid, and I never wanted to be a writer, and so it was wonderful, actually, to just stumble over it.
So we were talking in the green room earlier, and there are some elements of the book that are sort of not autobiographical, but you live them. Can you tell us a little bit? This book takes place partly in a very exclusive club called the Pitt Club. And, you know, I had known at Yale and Harvard there's Skull and Key, and there are all these very, you know, secretive male clubs. Well, it turns out they have them at, you know, Cambridge and Oxford, which I should have figured out because that's probably why they have them at Yale. So you were talking about how you were a member of some of these clubs and you got to see what was going on. When you were there, did you ever think you'd be writing about it, or were there things about it that would just sort of, you know, you were very curious about that you thought you could maybe explain by trying to write about them?
Yeah. It's interesting the way you talk about it already portrays so much how you dislike them, right?
Of the clubs.
Yeah. And how many of them have you been?
Well, my brother was a member of one of them, though he refuses to acknowledge it. That's a really good point, because what happens is that the character finds friendship in those clubs, and yet they are elite institutions that in themselves, because they're so elite, they have an impact on society. So that's what I think of it. I don't live my world in that, so I don't have a love, true love or hate for them.
So I always thought, you know, like secretive elite institutions like that are probably bad, but I wanted to know, so I thought I tried to find out, and that's how I became a member of some very weird institutions. So but in the end, I believe if you're talking about a place like Cambridge, and I don't know, I've never been to Harvard or any American university, so I can't really say anything about them, but I guess it's the same principle. We create our society around elites. We do that. I mean, go 300 meters up the road. I snuck into the university yesterday and played basketball with the kids, and one of them told me tuition is $80,000?
No, not here.
Well, it's what he told me what he paid. He's from New York. So,
He's an out-of-state student.
So,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, and if you realize that, of course it's an elite institution. That's what we do. I mean, we are an elite here, right? I mean, we are able, look, this book costs $26. It's the same principle, and I think it's hypocritical to say, yeah, but this is books and this is clubs. It's not a different thing. In the end, it's the same thing. I don't have anything against elite in principle. I think snobbery is a different thing. If you cultivate being different and having more money and power, then that is something the spies. Mm-hmm. And that is something people do in Cambridge, not just within the clubs. Within the clubs, you can see it more clearly because they were a certain kind of tie and you know they belong. But, I mean, going to Cambridge in itself is doing that. So, and I was just fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to see what happens behind these doors, and then I saw, and I was happy when they opened them and let me in.
Okay. So, Lauren, your main character, Marie Mitchell, is a trained FBI agent. She goes undercover as a spy. But that's not all. She's secretive about almost everything else in her life, and she shields her life from people. She's estranged from her mom. She's at odds with her dad at times. She doesn't seem to feel at home really anywhere in the world. So being secretive is not just part of her FBI or CIA persona. It's her survival mechanism. It's her way of approaching the world. And I was very interested in that. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about why you portrayed her that way. And, you know, she is a black spy in a very hierarchical, racist organization, but that sort of, you know, that racism sort of extends through lots of other parts of her world.
I'm sorry, I'm still like think. So this
woman is closed off to the world. She professionally is closed off to the world. That's what she's supposed to be, but it seems that personally she's very closed off as well.
Yeah.
And it does seem that racism was part of the reason in the book. And I was, you know, and I've, you know, read some of the things that you've spoken about the book, and you are talking about how often being black in this society, you are, you know, you're more guarded until, you know, everything is going to be fine. And that seemed to be what you imbued this character with. And I was wondering if you could tell us about why you did that.
Well, I think she's secretive because she is a spy. And I feel like it's kind of a weird tick in our social, like, idea and social convention about, like, the kind of celebrity spy. That's, like, a very weird idea. Like, look, there must be terrible. If you can recognize James Bond across the room in a casino, he's got to be the worst possible spy. Their whole business is, like, you know, in accessing information, like, and in the power in information. I do think, though, that she is... So she is closed off from things because it feels like that's a form of self-preservation. And then things are closed off from her because of some of the things that I feel that Takis was just talking about. I disagree. I don't think snobbery is the worst of it. I think that that's probably the least lethal part of these, like, structures that we're talking about. I think, like, I don't know, like, she doesn't... For example, she's really, really, really a very smart person, but it never occurs to her. She, you know, I have her go to a city university. It never occurs to her that she has access to a school like Columbia, you know, because like there are things coded into that, you know. Like it's based on something true. My mother was really brilliant. It never occurred to her that she went to college. She started college at 15. Didn't occur to her that she could go to, you know, Columbia or these kinds of, or like an Ivy League school. So I think, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I think that we do have, like, I do want to challenge these, like, the structures that we're talking about here. Yeah, I mean, there is an elitism that comes with books and literature, of course, but I don't think that just saying, like, not challenging it is the solution. I do resent, like, secret societies, because I think that, I don't know, the level of privilege and entitlement afforded to people who can be in these spaces, it's chosen, it's arbitrary and self-reinforcing, and I don't know, I feel like these power struggles or power structures are really harmful to all of us. I don't think, you know, I don't know. I feel pretty comfortable saying that I do resent knowing that I live in a world where there are secret societies. I can think what George W. Bush was in one, and it feels like that's why he was vaulted into a president.
Skull and bones, it was.
When he should have clearly just been an artist. You know, I feel like a lot of international, you know, like it's just a lot of foreign policy might have looked really different if the world wasn't like that. I mean, I don't know. I'm not really.
Your character's in a secret society.
But I feel like, so she's an FBI agent, right? But she's not involved in the, she's not initially recruited by the CIA because there is a lot of elitism in that program as well. There was, like, Harvard was a pipeline, to spies, to CIA officers.
Did you do much research about, in the 80s, were there many or any black female FBI agents?
FBI agents, yes, I read about. CIA agents, talking about my mom again, she was like kind of recruited in her, like, in the 80s. She's obviously not a spy, but she, I don't know, I...
That's what you think.
Yeah. There's a story in this where, like, this, like, character loses her address book, and she's kind of convinced that it's because someone stole it, and that really happened to my mother. She was, like, she went to D.C. for a weekend, and then was, like, lost this thing, and was pretty convinced that it was because of the course of, you know, of interviews that she'd gone through.
Mm-hmm. Christian, so your book is narrated by John Fraser, who's just returned from the Vietnam War with a nasty heroin habit. And he goes to Placer County, to Auburn, to his grandmother's house.
Gets funnier and funnier.
And it's a place he spent in his youth and a place he sort of regards as a sanctuary, a refuge of sorts. But instead of, you know, going to a place where he can find peace, he finds himself immersed into a place with secrets, with this deep history of racism, and with very few people willing to tell the truth. So I was so struck by this dichotomy. I mean, this, you know, orchard-growing, agricultural, placid landscape that contains this ugly, ugly history, which John Fraser, through the course of the book, is exposed to, Anyway, what I wanted to ask you about was the way you wrote the narrative. I mean, as you talked about, it's not a linear narrative. You could have talked about, you know, the Takahashi family and the Wilson family and how they started out as friends and then the war happened and then there were tensions between them. But instead you layer it in this very interesting way where you have John Fisher accompanying his aunt and Mrs. Takahashi on a quest to find out things. And in some ways that it doesn't blunt the impact of what happens, but it's filtered in a really interesting way. And I was curious why you approached it like that.
Probably just... I don't know.
Okay, next question.
You know, I guess I thought memory sort of works that way, and the narrator really is supposedly trying to write a book about Vietnam, and his involvement in this other narrative that involves the disappearance of Ray Takahashi, the son of a soldier who comes back from World War II and was fighting in the 42nd and then sort of disappears, and that nobody really knows what happened to him. He becomes involved in that story largely because he is it's a great distractor for him And this is true of like any kind of research that you do when you're writing. You know, it's like libraries are a great way to spend a whole day writing.
Yeah.
You know, like you feel super productive. You haven't done shit. You probably took like a 3-hour lunch, you know, and had like 80 cups of coffee and gotten lost in some other section of the library or whatever. But yes, honey, I had a super productive day at the library today. Thank you for asking. And that's John. You know, he's the narrator is trying to make sense of what he did in Vietnam, and he was the radio man of his unit. He effectively called in airstrikes. He says repeatedly in the book, "I know that I killed all kinds of people. I know they were people. I would do it again if it meant that I would live." Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the cold hard truth of his experience. His interest in the story and his difficulty in piecing it together in a way that makes chronological sense has a lot to do with memory, a lot to do with how the story comes to him, and a lot to do with a book I really love, which is Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom, which I've read, probably 30 times, and I still don't understand it at all. The book is utterly scrambled. Yeah. It's all told out of order, but one thing I really like about it is the narrator of that book knows more of the story than the reader does all the time. And so he tells the story and he says, and then Cora did this, and occasionally you have the roommate of the narrator step in and go, wait a minute, who's Cora now, right? And then he's able to step back in the narrative and go, oh, Cora is Stryker sitting right here in the front. Cora is this person, and then he goes off on another tangent, and then the narrator gets interrupted again. Wait a minute, who is that person now? Oh, yeah, right. And then he goes on another tangent over here. I'm not sort of angling. And I really like that. I like the idea that you trust the reader so much that you're willing to challenge them with the basic material of the narrative, which is not to say withholding something or purposefully obfuscating the obvious facts of it, but just supplying them with the knowledge of the story in the way you would if you were telling a rad story at a bar and you were drunk. You know, where you go like, wait a minute, but I forgot to tell you about this other thing, you know? And I think there's a certain kind of power in that narrative structure or strategy, because there's a moment at which the reader goes, oh shit, like that means, you know, and then they put the dominoes together that lead you to the end of the book. And hopefully those dominoes snap together right when you, the writer, are writing the end of the book. Mm-hmm. So they go like, oh shit, you know, and then they're suddenly in it. But the whole time you're doing sort of a bait and switch with them to try to feed them pieces of the narrative, which aren't secrets. They're just, some of it's super mundane. It's just, that's how real stories, I think, come to us. They come to us in pieces and parts, and we get little chunks of it, and we try to sort of assemble it all together in a way that hopefully will lead to some sense of a novel as kind of a unit. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
God, I just go on.
No, that was fine.
These are hard questions. It's hard not to feel like you want to give as full an answer as possible.
Right. So these books are all, I think, intensely political. Lauren, your book is about the Cold War, and it's not the Cold War that is the most obvious history of the Cold War, of espionage going on in Europe, but it's about the Cold War and the U.S. attempt at destabilizing, you know, pro-communist African regimes. Christian, your book is about internment and race relations and, you know, just this awful history of in America that we don't really talk a lot about. And Takis, you write a lot about, you know, elitism, for better or worse, you know, sexism, sexual violence, and sort of the Me Too movement. And I'm wondering if you guys can each take a couple minutes to tell me if you sort of wanted to be explicitly political, if this was something that you didn't quite realize what you were doing, but it came out in the course of your writing, you know, if it came from somewhere as a gut that you only, you know, eventually sort of realize as you're writing the book. Do you want to start, Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, it was always my intention to be political. I felt like if I was going to write about a spy and about American foreign policy, that it was, you know, I was going to be political and critical. So, yeah, and I figured also you know, year four, I was like, I may never do this again, so let me just throw everything I have and then put everything I possibly can into this book, because there may not be a second one.
And so what were you hoping to illuminate? What history do you think that you wanted to make sure your readers knew about that they might not have otherwise known about?
Well, about Africa and particularly West Africa as a, you know, Cold War theater, which we don't really think about, but, you know, and the Angolan Civil War was absolutely a proxy war between us and the Soviet Union. Lots of people died. And also, I was really attracted to Thomas Sankara as a figure. I think he's, especially, he was very charismatic. He created a lot of positive social change in a very short period of time. He's not very well known in this country, even though, you know, Che is a very popular figure, and I feel like there are some similarities between them, even down to the fact that he would ride around the capital city on a motorcycle.
With a red beret.
Yeah, very, very charismatic. And I felt like I wanted him to be someone who was better known in this country, because I felt like that the history was an important one to me. I wanted other people to know about it.
And it's so interesting to read, like, all the initiatives he did, like vaccinate kids and try and ending, you know, a female genital mutilation, and all these things that seem fantastic, and yet they were interpreted by the United States as, you know, pro-Soviet, communist, things that the U.S. didn't want to support in any way. And now, I mean, I think our world has moved on now, and we see the complexities of it, but that really stood out for me, like, just, you know, why did they have to go after this person who seemed like he had a nuanced view of some things, at least?
I guess I wonder how much we've moved on, I think, is kind of maybe where, why I was writing this now, you know, so.
Okay. So, Takis, your book, you know, has to do with, In the Pit Club, there's a secret, even more secret society called the Butterfly Club, and I don't want to reveal too much because it's sort of the end of the book, and this is a real page turner. But it does have to do with men and women and sex. And your book came out just as the Me Too movement was really, you know, getting strong in the U.S. I don't know if there have been similar discussions in Germany about it, but what was it about that issue that you wanted to highlight? And, you know, you feel lucky that your book sort of coincided with this larger social movement?
And maybe to answer the second question first, no, I don't, because I think it's shameful that in 2019 or 18 we have to deal with this, because it's because sexual violence is... It's just so wrong, and it's also so dumb. And I never wanted to be a political writer, because I honestly didn't want to be a fictional writer. It's just something I never thought about. What I want to be is a good citizen. I believe that I was lucky enough to see many countries which don't have liberal democracies as we do in Germany or here, where we are allowed to debate whether or not Trump is a good president and why he was voted into power. And I worked as a war reporter for a couple of years, so I've been to places... where people have real problems, and I believe our duty as citizens is to be political in everything we do, and I believe that means to have a certain set of values we stand for, and we bring forth, we make clear that we believe in that, and I try to do that when I buy a coffee in the morning. In the way I I live my relationships to my friends and parents and with people I don't know, and also in the way I write books. And I think as a writer, you have no choice but to express what you believe in through your book. And so it was exactly as you phrased it in your question. It just happened to be that way that I wrote about this. Not because I thought, okay, we need to address this, but because I believe the way I wrote about it is kind of the way I believe is how we should think about it. Maybe not how we should think about how I think about it. That's why I did it. I know it's a little twisted, but I hope that makes sense.
I'm just always amazed that fiction writers, like, and I am a nonfiction writer, they're like something in the air that you absorb that tells you what the discussion, I mean, they're not even the most necessarily the most obvious discussions in society, but there's something that's going on at a lower level that many, you know, novelists pick up and then choose to write about, and then it comes out and it can be so timely. I'm not
just
really...
Maybe to add one thing, so I wrote this book before Me Too was a phrase. And then it came out, and then we were selling the film rights at that moment. So all the, and that's a really weird aspect of being a writer. And all the agents dealing with the film rights were super excited and said, "Oh, it's fantastic."
Harvey Weinstein, he'll want
especially
it.
Especially look at the Americans, how they freak out. Now we can sell this to 20th Century Fox. And as a writer, you think, yeah. In a way, that's great, yeah. On the other hand, it's absurd, right? Because then Me Too becomes almost pop culture.
Modified.
Right? We all think it's great to put it on our T-shirt because it shows that we're standing on the right side. I mean, I currently live in New York, and on Broadway, 300 meters from where I live, is the first gender-free store. I didn't even know what that meant. Where they sell shirts for $40 that say respect and stuff like that. I keep walking here through Berkeley. I don't even know what it stands for, and it says resist.
Anti-Trump, yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's pop culture, right?
Yeah.
That's not being political.
Yeah, it feels like we can't understand things without commodifying them. I also sold my film rights, and there was a lot of excitement because this was a black female spy, and that was like a thing that I can just, you can sort of see like the dollar signs like in an agent's eyes, and it's like, you know, and it feels like, okay, well, they're interested in this now because this identity is hot. And it's always concerning when an identity is in vogue, because, you know, then you'll say, you know, it can go out of style. And that's like that's a kind of a distressing way to think about something that is fundamental to who you are.
And how about you in the politics of what you wrote about?
If anyone wants to buy my film rights, I'll sell them to you right now. How much money you got? Like Takis, I started the book before Trump. Before the subject of the book became newsworthy again. And I think like Takis, I was sort of horrified that it was... topical in a way, although in retrospect I think it's maybe productive that our sort of patriarchal embedded kind of racism is like right at the surface in a way that maybe it really hasn't been maybe ever in this country. Again, I'm talking through my privilege. But I was horrified when I was finishing the book. Suddenly we were interning people at the border and this kind of stuff was happening. I did kind of drag my feet a little bit during the editing. The editing process on this book took a long time. And I did nothing to rush that process, sort of hoping that it would not be topical anymore, which I guess was just sort of a weird way to kind of deal with my own kind of internalized discomfort at having written about this subject to begin with, and then having it, and then being horrified that it was showing up in the news. But again, you know, if you write a book about a historical event that white Americans in particular have chosen to not spend much time discussing, it can't be a bad thing to have it show up on the news suddenly. I mean, at least it's newsworthy and being talked about, and we're dealing with that injustice again in a way that we should always be dealing with and acknowledging.
So a couple times, Christian, you have mentioned your awareness of being a white privileged male writing about race. And Takis, we talked a little bit of this about in the green room. I did see one review that sort of saying the book had this white savior, you know, hero come in the end to rescue a woman. And I was wondering if we could the cultural appropriation is a very, hot topic in the literary world. It's a very, very difficult topic to grapple with. The question of, can you only write about, what you know and who you are? Or if you're an artist, do you have the ability to go into other people's backgrounds and minds and try to write about them? And I'm just, wondering, Christian, maybe you could talk a little bit about, a little bit more about why you were so worried. I mean, and how you went about trying to make sure that what you wrote was okay and wasn't insulting. And Takis, you too, we had this conversation also about your second book, which is called Stella, which has come out in Germany this year, and it's become a controversial book. And you don't know that Takis is a very world-famous author as a result of this controversial book. And it's been a difficult time because of this whole question of cultural appropriation a little bit. So I'm just wondering if either one of you want to, and Lauren, and you too, if you have thoughts about this, what you'd like to say about what can authors do and what should they avoid?
Funny thing is, I think I'll be, so Stella comes out here next year, I think I've just heard the term cultural appropriation for the first time. I think I hear it a lot. you want to start?
No, I don't. I do not want to start.
I think you just said something that kind of gets to the core of thinking about it. You said, how did you make sure your book is not insulting? I think it's okay if a novel is insulting. I mean, that's why I think a novel is art, okay? Art is not about saying what's right and wrong. It's not doing the good thing. It's about thinking about who we are and who we want to be. And I think we do that by challenging our beliefs. And I think we do that by also, I mean, which I didn't do, I have to say that. I mean, it sounds as if this book is super controversial. I don't think it is. But I think it would be okay if it was. I think I believe that's what art is for in the end. So Stella, and just to give you an idea why this this was controversial in Germany, especially, I wrote a novel based on a real person, a woman called Stella Goldschlag, who lived in the 40s in Berlin in the Nazi era, and she was Jewish, and she collaborated with the Nazis and hunted Jews for them to save the life of her parents and her own life. And of course, and I completely understand that, it's a very sensitive subject if you talk about it in Germany. And the debate was stormy. So the questions we were talking about, for example, were, is it okay if I write this book?
Because you're not Jewish.
Because I'm not Jewish. And I actually, I think writing is doubting, because writing is making decisions. And I think if you're careful about your decision making, there has to be a certain amount of doubt involved in it. That's it. That's normal. That's the same if you read Harry Potter. And so, of course, I wasn't sure. But I remember this moment when I asked a friend of mine who survived Auschwitz, and was 92 years old, when I talked to him about this, and he said, well, why shouldn't you write this book? I mean, it's not about how you call your God. It's about what kind of book you write. And when we talked about this earlier, I said, so I'm published in Germany in the same publishing house as Colson Whitehead, and you probably all know the Underground Railroad. If you don't, and if you only want to spend $26 today, don't buy my book. By the Underground Railroad. And it's about a young woman who runs away from a slave. You say slave farm? Is that a slave? Is that a word?
Plantation.
Yeah. And I thought, and Colson Whitehead is black. And I thought, would it not be good enough to win the Pulitzer if I had written it without being black? I think that's nonsense. So I wrote about sexual violence in my book, and I'm neither a victim of sexual violence nor am I a woman. I think that means that I have to be very careful when I write about it and do a lot of research, and I tried to do that, and I think it's still okay.
So you bring up the fact that people were questioning whether you could have done Stella since you're not Jewish. Well, I think that's sort of similar to some of the discussion that's happening in the United States. And the United States, I think, is reckoning in this era with the fact that this is a country built primarily on slavery and exploitation of people of other races. And so, you know, people who are descendants of those slaves and people who are immigrants are, you know, saying, you know, white people, you know, we're a little tired of you necessarily telling our stories. There are other ways to look at this. And this is what you, Viet says. And yet, at the same time...
Wait, I'm sorry for jumping in, but I mean, yeah. I mean, if you don't want to listen to the story, don't listen. Buy a different book. I mean, so what's wrong with telling the story? I mean, you should. I mean, look. I mean, one of our greatest values is our freedom. Of course. I mean, of course, you're allowed to write what you want to write. Why not? If you're white, male, privileged, whatever. I mean, why shouldn't you? I mean, why shouldn't you be allowed to write that?
Everyone can write whatever they want to write. I truly believe that. But a lot of the time, what's at the heart of this conversation is, like, for me, is the quality of the work. Like, I'm thinking of the people who are like lightning rods for this right now. I'm thinking of like Lionel Shriver and Bret Easton Ellis and Joyce Carol Oates. All white writers who had received a backlash because of the books that they've written, and with things having to do with cultural appropriation. But none of those books were very good, to be honest. I think that, like, it's not like there's I feel like it's a straw man argument to say that it's about an individual and an individual should be able to write whatever they want. I don't think that that's at the heart of what this conversation is about. It's Shit, this is we're really like wading into some really, really difficult waters. Because, okay, like the example that you just said, like about Colson Whitehead's book, and like if you wrote a book, that identical book, that it would be, you know, would it not deserve a Pulitzer because you were white? It's incredibly, the presumption is in that you could write that caliber of book about, like this experience. Like you would need there's a lot of information there, that's experiential and like kind of fundamental to black America. You know, it's not even necessarily that you're also German. Like it's fundamental to American experience as well. So like I don't, you know, we frame it in ways that I'm just like, I push on the framing too. So, yeah, I just...
Hey, I didn't say I could write the book. I said, what happened if I had written the exact same book?
And I'm saying, in my opinion, I don't think that you have that capacity.
No, right? I mean, I'm not claiming that I do, but the question,
but if that's... No,
and,
but if,
and also, I mean, how can you say Easton Ellis wrote a bad book? I mean, because, I mean, it's a bestseller, right? People, obviously, people think it's pretty good.
Are we talking about White?
Yeah.
Because I think he's been a hack for a while now. And I think that he's a provocateur in this way that's like very, very boring. So I
completely agree. But I mean, obviously, people think it's great. That's why they buy it.
I think that people don't. I don't think so. I think he's been dining out on less than zero for like, you know, did you read that? There was like an interview with him and it was just beautiful. The interviewer gave him just the down to the millimeter enough rope for him to hang himself. And like, because he's not a public intellectual. He's like, if any, trying to get him to make any sort of statement or claim that is his own or original or in any way insightful and not purely about provocation was impossible because he doesn't really think any of this through. It's just a, you know, he
look,
okay.
I completely agree. I read, I don't know, one third of the book. I thought it was boring. I thought it was only about being provocative without actually saying anything clever. Okay. I completely disagree with him. And I also believe that he still lives off below zero and American Psycho and so on. But why shouldn't he be allowed to write it? That's the thing. That's the only claim I'm trying to make. Of course he should be allowed to write it so we can think it's bad because that's what democracy is.
Yeah, he should be able to write it. He has the freedom of speech and I have the freedom of speech to criticize it and say that
absolutely.
This is
that's
poor caliber work. And I can go further and say, man, I wish some young, hungry, you know, person had gotten this book deal, you know, instead of him because I would have much preferred to see that story. He can keep it on his blog, he can do that. You know, I wish that if people are getting paid well for their books, which not a lot of people are, I want it to go to someone who I'm interested in, who I think is an interesting thinker, and I don't think that Bret Easton Ellis is one.
I agree.
But we also live in a time where, you know, Donald Trump has tried to inflame the waters of race at every turn. And so maybe Bret Easton Ellis is also capitalizing on, if I am as outrageous and obnoxious as possible, that's going to get me attention because,
yeah.
Like Donald Trump, it works
boring.
For him. Yeah,
I mean, jeez, yeah. Like it's just so boring.
So, but I want to just go back to what you were saying. I mean, clearly, you were saying that Collis Whitehead, you know, brings this long history and knowledge of, you know, his history, his family's history that he can bring to a book and make it as amazing as it is. How, if you want to write about someone that isn't, you know, for you to write about a white character, or you to write about a Japanese American character, and Takis is saying, you know, we should all be able to do that. How can you approach it in a way that isn't insulting to people of that race and is done sensitively? Is there a way to do that?
I think so. I mean, I think that you need to, like, to create a complicated character is really what is that for me is like what the question is here. Like I'm struggling because I feel like I wanna in my actually you know what? I don't know. I'm just gonna
I'm
say
sorry, yeah,
I would say yeah, like I think it's possible, but I just think that like I think it's possible. I think it's very doable. I think it comes down to having the talent and the time and the energy and the desire to create characters who are really complicated, and not to do the what's his name Franzen thing where he's like all of my characters are white because that's like the people in my life, like get a new life. Like I mean I feel like that's a failure if you can't base like any of your non-white characters on like non-white people in your life. That's like a failing in your life that is reflected in the literature that this person has created. Like, I mean, I do feel like if a person is, a white male cis person is creating characters, you know, based on developed characters based on people in their life, you know, like that's a good way to start. I can't speak to every person how that's going to play out because it plays out so differently for everyone. But I do think at the end of the day, if what is valuable here too is to just say that anyone can write anything that they want, but like there's going to be a response, and like you don't have to. That's fine. Like, you know, it's like, I guess to sort of cry uncle and to say, oh, you know, I'm being victimized here because of like the PC police and this cultural appropriation, you know, backlash when you just wrote bad characters. Like that's an unfair characterization of the criticism that I think a lot of people are receiving. And that's where I have the issue. Like it's not, I'm not interested in dictating to any author what they can and cannot write. But I don't care for that response because I think it's easy. And I think it does speak to a type of privilege that, you know, if you were an author worth your salt, you would want to examine. So,
right. So Christian, I'd like you to just answer this as well. But we're going to start taking questions. And if people can, this guy, I can throw you off the bus. You get over on the microphone. I know this is a tough topic, and I'm sorry to bring it up. But you did raise it a few times. And I do think, I mean, you know, you did it well. You wrote a really compassionate book and a really, it just sort of about killed me, the ending of your book. And, you know, the betrayal that you write about between this white family and this family that's come from Japan. I mean, I was so mad at the end. I can't tell you. It just felt like, you know, it was so senseless. And if you could just add a few thoughts.
Thank you.
I told you. Okay, he's going off the bus right now, this guy. Okay, anyway.
I don't know. I sent my we have a thing called sensitivity readers in literature, in literary arts. I think if you are writing outside your lane and you don't have a bunch of friends and people that you love who occupy that lane, then what the hell are you doing it for? Thank you. I think had any of my friends who I trust and love, who are people of color, had told me, Christian, your book is bullshit, I would have pulled it. I would have. Fortunately, they gave me lots of good feedback and helped me with some issues of culture, issues of language, issues of occupying a certain skin or a certain gender, or a certain politics that I don't occupy. I'm not interested in being a provocateur at all. I'm really interested in subtlety in literature. That's what I want. I'm here to break your heart. And if I've written a bad character, I'm not doing that work. I'm offending or not treating the subject with enough respect. And that doesn't necessarily just limit that comment to the Japanese American characters in the book. That's all the characters in the book, even the ones that you fucking hate.
Yeah. That's like what writing a book is. That's like what writing literature is.
Yeah. I mean, you're in the business of breaking hearts. I mean, for me, that's what you're doing. But again, it's a comedy. It's so funny.
So after we take questions, you're going to have an opportunity to buy these books and get them signed by these authors. And I just have had the best couple of weeks reading these books. They're all really, really, really good. And they're all easy to read books. So you should all buy all three of them. So do we have any questions?
And the Colson Whitehead.
You have to please, I think you're supposed to go to that side of the room.
Oh, you are? Is that
yes.
What we're doing? Okay.
Yeah, because they're taping it. They have
they're taping it.
Yes.
Well, let me.
So when we look at ourselves, we don't frequently see our own privilege. And when we're writing characters, that any character is going to look through the world from their own viewpoint. And so you don't frequently look at it and say, oh, yeah, I'm really privileged in this. So how often do you try to use secondary characters as a lens to the privilege or the culture that the first character is going through, and how does that translate into your writing?
So, Takis, you write about Josh a lot. That sort of he sort of serves as a different viewpoint of that world.
Yeah, but the truth, and this is a really disappointing answer, but I've never thought about this in my entire life. I have 8 different perspectives on the same story in my book, of people of, and saying this after I've written 2 more books, I think the biggest flaw of the club is there's the characters are too extreme. They're too clean in there that you know. Okay, that's the snob. That's the gay boxer who doesn't get his shot. That's the victim of So the whole story moves forward by how different these people look at the events and how they reflect on what it does to them. So I think I'm probably the worst person to answer this, because that's the entire idea of my book. I think that, and that's very selfish in the end, but writing fiction allows you to learn about you in the end as a writer, because, before writing this, I didn't have much reason to deal with sexual violence. I was never a victim, and I'm not close with any victims of sexual violence. And today I deal with it a lot through different aspects. I think that's one goal one big advantage of fiction. That's also why I believe it's important that we write about stuff that's not only natural to what it's in our sphere, because that would mean that I would be writing about white privilege shit, because that's who I am without choosing it. I think we have to kind of go further than that.
Marie, the main character in my mind, has a lot of color privilege. I think she's relatively, I always think of her as relatively light, and I think that she also is beautiful, which is a type of privilege. So there is a type of ease that I see the world opening up in certain ways for her because of those things. I don't think that she would be in certain places. But she also, even though I think of her as having a lot of color privilege and a lot of circumstances, then she does have family in which, you know, they think of her as dark, or her hair as not being good. So I think for me, she kind of, I have like boundaries on, I thought of boundaries on both sides. And even if I wasn't always explicit to understand her and her choices, I felt like there was a type of privilege that she had that she couldn't see, but that it was part of like who she was and why she was in certain positions in the first place. It was an important question for me, even if I wasn't like really explicitly having like a character reinforce it. So like people notice it, but I don't think that they explicitly say this is a, or she doesn't necessarily see it as an expression of privilege, but I certainly did.
So let's lighten it up a little bit. Your romance between Marie and the head of Burkina Faso, I thought, was very romantic. So who would you like to see play those roles in the movie?
Ooh,
people ask me that all the time, and because of the color thing, it's so funny. I didn't know who she looked like, but there was a woman who just won Miss USA, and in my head, that's kind of almost like exactly what she looks like. She's got like big curls.
It's the one Game of Thrones woman.
It's a UK company, so they might choose British actress, and I'm not as familiar with them. But there's a guy who I feel think is like it would be a good Sankara is like he was in the in this in Us, like he plays the dad. I forgot his name, but he's also Black Manta, I think, or Mamba in the Jason Momoa Aquaman. He's very handsome.
The older dad?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, the dad in the 80s.
And Takis, what happened with that woman in Austria? Did it work out?
She left me.
Oh.
But, I mean...
You said you're going to lighten it up.
I know. I thought for sure he was going to say, you know, I swept her off the feet. Yeah.
Come on, Takis. You're not pulling your weight.
Yeah, no, I know. So maybe to lighten it up, I married her and then she left me.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my God.
That's even worse. What can I say to lighten up your mood? You've been going through a really hard time with your daughter being in the hospital. Christian is an amazingly hard worker. He not only is an editor of the Paris Review, you teach at two universities, you have seven children, and you write a lot. And his youngest daughter has just been hospitalized but has been happily released from the hospital. What's her favorite thing to do? What was the thing you were so excited about to show her when she got home or do with her when she got home?
Oh, she loves to wrap her hand into my mustache, put her foot against my face and pull as hard as she can to wake me up. It's so relaxing.
So you have to let her do it, huh?
You know, it's great. We were in the hospital for 3 months, so and we were all at the Ronald McDonald House with my other kids, and my wife didn't leave the hospital a single time in 3 months.
Wow.
And so I just ran back and forth doing her laundry and bringing her meals and stuff. But it's just, you know, my youngest is two, Vivian. She has Down syndrome, so she has this sort of like, I mean, she's the Down syndrome thing is magic. I would suggest everybody get it. She just wakes up. She's happy as hell all day long, every day. And it's just having everybody together and having that back with us again. It was just fucking awful having the family be split like that. And I made a decision as a parent to bring everybody with me and just keep everyone together. It's like the grapes of wrath or something. Like you gotta hold the family together. I don't know if it was the right decision. I mean, all my kids are now failing out of their grades and everything else. But for me, it was just that's what you have to do. Was there a question or am I just talking?
You're just talking, but that's okay. We're used to it. No, one more thing.
She's home.
May I ask a question? She's back home.
May I ask you a question? Because, like, is your book actually as funny as the stuff you
see? No, it's not funny at all.
It's not funny at all.
No.
That's a shame. It's a shame because I wasn't sure if that's a joke and it's funny or... But it's not funny.
Not a single funny thing that happens in the book. It's a total fucking bummer from the first sentence to the last.
But I read something that you've already completed two other manuscripts. So you're going to take the next year off just hanging with your family or you're going to... That's the intent anyway to...
Well, I got one more book that I'm writing.
Oh, okay.
But then I think I will actually stop for a while and just spend some time with my family, see if my wife wants to go do something, like go back to school or go have a career. Or I've got a lot of bandwidth, so I can teach, you know, I can like keep doing my six classes and just not, you know, she's a full-time mom. She's been a full-time mom for a long time. And I just feel like it's her, you know, I've taken enough of the prime real estate in our life, and it's time for her to have a time with that.
That's so great. Yeah. So, Lauren, you know, going from novel number one to novel number two can be hard, especially, you know, when you have such a successful novel and you're doing as much, you know, talking about it. Have you been able to move into that space where you're doing any writing yet? Or
nope. I've sold out. I've sold out, baby. I moved to LA.
Oh,
and
good.
I'm writing for TV now, and it is sweet.
Really, are you on a show? Or are you gonna?
Yeah, it's coming out in 2021.
Ooh.
If there is a 2021, it is great to just sit in a room with eight other people and just say nonsense from 10 to 5 and write it down, and yeah, let's see if it...
Can you tell us any themes or plots of the show?
It's a spy show. it's a spy show. And they were like, are you worried about being typecast? And I'm like, nope. Nope. Yes, please. It's like super, the showrunner wrote Ghost Protocol, the Mission Impossible movie. So it is pure fun. And it's a lot. Yeah, it's a totally different way of writing, but I really like it. I like it too.
Great. Cool. And Takis, you just came out with another book in Germany. Are you just still in the whole promotion mode, or do you know what your next adventure is?
No promotion mode. I've written the next, unfortunately for Germany, scandalous book, because I've written together with another person. So I co-authored his biography, and it's the biography of an Auschwitz survivor.
Yeah.
And now I'm writing a book which I'm not going to publish under my name and under my color of skin and under my gender, because I believe it should just be the book.
Okay, well, we can look forward to that. So can we give our panelists a round of applause? Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.